coming up on Simply Superior. It's one of the most challenging roles for any soprano. And this week, a Wisconsinite who brought it to Duluth takes it to one of the world's greatest opera stages. Then, don't throw out your 2019 calendar just yet. There might be some pictures, prose, and music worth saving as we take a look back on the region's arts and entertainment scene.
Deep in these woods, we find a shack, all wrapped in tar paper. It's hot outside, but the shack looks cold and empty.
All that after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Here's a musical event going on right now that's a real local girl makes good story. By local, I mean Wisconsin and a little bit of the Twin Ports. The Duluth Connection is a 2015 performance of Mozart's The Magic Flute, and the soprano playing the Queen of the Night was Wisconsin native Jenny Hauser. As you can clearly hear, the role is one of the most demanding in opera. And since her Duluth performance, Jenny Hauser has taken it across the country, including the Madison Opera, Central City Opera, where this recording was made, and starting this week, the Met. Jenny Hauser joins us from New York. Hello, Jenny. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thank you, Robin. Glad to be here.
And did I get that right? Well, you've been everywhere, so tell me where else you've taken this.
Well, yes, I should say, I think you said Madison Opera in there, and I actually haven't sung The Queen of the Night in Madison. I sang it in Minnesota, and I've sung other roles in Madison, but I didn't actually do the magic flute there.
Well, you better stop what you're doing right now and go back to Madison and do that, okay?
Sure. I'm watching.
An emergency performance.
Yes, of course. I have sung The Queen of the Night with Minnesota Opera, Cincinnati Opera, Central City Opera, Dallas Opera, Los Angeles Opera, one performance with the Glimmerglass Festival. That might be it. And now, yes, rehearsing at the Met.
And the Met must have been the only thing left for you to do with all that.
It does feel like one of those companies that you kind of always have your eye on. So once you've performed a number of other places, you hope that maybe that one day that call will come.
When did you first get your eye on a role, and when did you first embrace it?
Well, I worked on the arias. She, of course, has two big arias, and that's basically the whole role. And I had worked on the arias when I was in graduate school a little bit. So that was like 2011. But I never performed the role until 2015. So my first go at it was with the Glimmerglass Festival, and then with Minnesota Opera shortly after that, which was the company that brought the production to Duluth. That was actually probably my second time performing the role when I sang it in Duluth.
Wow. And backing up even further, you're originally from Richland Center?
I was born in Richland Center, yes. I grew up mostly in Stoughton, Wisconsin, which is right outside of Madison. That's where I went to middle school and high school, and it's where my parents still live today. So I consider that to be my main hometown.
I've been in both those towns, Richland Center and Stoughton, yes. But I'm going to go further back in that with the connection between you and me. I know a little bit about your family.
Yes.
I first met your grandfather, George Hauser, about, maybe almost 30 years ago now. And without going through the whole history of the 30 years, his history is, of course, extremely impressive. He was a co-founder of the Congress of Racial Equality. He was the co-leader with Bayard Rustin, a name that's become much more known than it was before in the Civil Rights Movement, co-leader of a freedom ride of whites and blacks who traveled in the South in 1947, way before the Civil Rights Movement began. And then later on, he headed an organization called the American Committee on Africa. And I met you at his memorial service. He died at age 99. in 2015. The rest of the connection is I did a documentary. It's probably the most important thing I ever did in my life.
No.
About the 1947 Freedom Ride. And George Hauser and the other survivors of that ride were gracious enough to join me for a reunion trip, which we filmed and we got on PBS. And there it is. It's called You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow.
I certainly have seen the documentary several times. And by the way, I find it to be a really compelling, wonderful piece. So I'm really, really glad that you made that wonderful documentary. But yeah,
this is a mutual admiration society right here.
Yes. It is exactly right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the first time I saw it was with my grandparents in New York.
Well, here's a clip from the documentary of postcards your grandfather, while on the Freedom Ride, wrote to your grandmother and her reading them almost 50 years later.
On April the 20th, I said I felt almost free today when I touched Cincinnati briefly.
I felt almost free yesterday when I touched Cincinnati briefly. Worthy and I rode the train from Cincy to Roanoke without being segregated. We ate in the unsegregated diner, too.
What sort of influence did your grandfather's life have on you?
Oh, my goodness.
And your grandmother's, tremendous. By the way.
Yes. And my grandmother's, yes, that's worth noting. They both, I think it was the two of them and their partnership that allowed him to do the important civil rights work that he did, and certainly had a huge influence on our whole family. Both of them. So, yeah, I mean, my whole life I've been aware of the work that he did and always felt that it was possible for one person to make a difference. So that was something that was ingrained in me from fairly young. And my grandmother,
for whom you're named,
yes, her name is Jean Hauser, and Jenny is sort of a, you know, partially a tribute to her. My grandfather called her Jeannie, so that was part of where my name came from. And she's a musician, and she actually is still going strong at 101 right now.
Wow.
And she's always been one of my favorite people on the planet. And she is a huge musical influence on me, and also just a huge influence in terms of what sort of person I want to be and how I want to live my life. So she was always a very loving and also a very strong and also a very smart and also, just all these wonderful characteristics. So, you know, both of them, both George and Jean, were always just so supportive of my interest in music, of all of my interests, but in particular of music. And when we would spend Christmases with them at their house in New York, they always encouraged me to practice, to play piano and sing every day. They would sit in the living room as if it were a concert when I was just making ugly sounds and practicing things.
Right. And I think it bears repeating of both your grandparents and, again, of George's activities with the Congress of Racial Equality back in 1942, that these were things that I got to know him quite well. And we would joke, normal people, if you will, wouldn't be doing at the time. It took much longer for the nation's consciousness to be raised.
And I think they, as you say, they helped to sort of start to raise the consciousness and lay out some of the framework for what, you know, became the much more famous Freedom Rides in the 1960s. And they were sort of trailblazers, and it was important that even though their particular works didn't, you know, immediately create some huge change, that they started to show people, this isn't okay, we need to do something about this.
The Magic Flute. Even if you had the musical influence of your grandparents, I'm suspecting you didn't grow up singing all the Mozart arias, did you?
No. No, I did not wake up singing this stuff as a kid or have any sense that I would ever do it professionally.
I was fortunate to have also my mother active in the civil rights movement and in arts. And when I was 3 years old, she took me to a performance at the Civic Opera House in Chicago of The Magic Flute. But it was performed by marionettes.
Oh, wow.
We got to go backstage, and I remember these marionettes were about the same size I was.
You know, the production that I'm working on right now at the Met actually involves giant puppets or marionettes. They don't have strings above them. They're operated by people sort of below and attached to them, but giant puppets are a part of this production. So it's interesting that your first experience was that, and my current experience also involves something similar.
Well, they may not be unrelated. Who knows if somebody in your production wasn't in the audience with as an 3-year-old. So
right.
I read one interview with you where it said, however, your favorite opera is not The Magic Flute, but is Peter Grimes?
Ooh, yes. Peter Grimes is definitely in my top five, yeah.
And this is a British opera, a 20th century, written by Benjamin Britten. How does that resonate with you? What's so special about that?
You know, it's sort of an enigmatic story of a community and of a sort of outcast. And, you know, when you watch it, you don't really know all the answers. You don't really know what's totally going on with the main character, Peter Grimes. But the thing for me about that opera is the music. Benjamin Britten just created the most incredible textures and really vibrant choral singing. And then one of the most special things about the opera is the sea interludes, which are orchestral interludes. They're just absolutely transporting symphonic music, you know, without any staging frequently and without any singing. My husband, who's a tenor, that was one of the first things we bonded over. There was some group discussion about favorite operas, and both of us said Peter Grimes as well.
And that's a perfect segue. Your husband is who?
His name is David Blaylock.
And am I correct, he's also performed in Duluth with the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra?
I think that's right. I had actually forgotten because I wasn't able to be with him when he performed in Duluth. But yes, he absolutely did.
Great. Have you two performed in Peter Grimes together, or is that yet to come?
No, neither of us have performed in Peter Grimes. And I don't know if we will. Yeah, we have worked together, yes. We have. We started dating when we were singing together with Virginia Opera in Norfolk, Virginia, and we have performed together with several other companies, and we have several shows coming up together. So we, most of the time, we don't work together. Most of the time, we're separate in our careers, but we really value the chances that we get to sing together. And I should say that we are actually performing with Madison Opera this season in April of 2020. Both David and I are in a production of Orpheus in the Underworld by Offenbach, being performed in English, a terrific comedy, a terrific retelling of the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. So we're very excited to be working at home and back with one of our favorite companies. I think it's going to be an incredible thing to work on.
It sounds wonderful. We will mark our calendars. We are talking to Jenny Houser, who is speaking to us from New York, where she is rehearsing in her final rehearsals with the Met as the Queen of the Night in Mozart's Magic Flute. That performance, if you are listening to this, which you probably are, on Friday, will have taken place the night before. And so walking out on that stage for the first time?
Well, I haven't done it yet. So one of the interesting things about the way that I am making my debut is that I don't get any stage rehearsal. So when I walk out there on Thursday, it will be the first time I'm singing on the Met stage.
All right. So what's next?
Well, I have a little bit of time off. My husband and I like to travel together if one of us is working and the other one isn't. So I will get to hang out and, you know, maybe cook some meals for him and whatnot while he works on a production of Don Giovanni right after this. And then I have a couple of master classes and some teaching engagements that I'm looking forward to before my next opera, which is, as I mentioned, Orpheus in the Underworld with Madison Opera. And then I have another Queen of the Night with New Orleans Opera directly after that. And then a couple more operas this summer and a couple of recital engagements. So I have a lot of music to learn during my downtime right after this and a lot of preparations for the next things coming up.
All right. And although I don't have any authority whatsoever to invite you to our concert halls or to our beautiful cathedral in Superior, where the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra occasionally plays, but you're more than welcome to bring any of the above performances to Duluth or just to stop by.
Oh, well, thank you. I really love Duluth and Superior, and I would be thrilled to be back.
All right. We've been talking to Jenny Houser, who is a few days at the time of our conversation ahead of her debut at the Met in the role of the Queen of the Night in Mozart's The Magic Flute. This is Simply Superior. We'll be back after this. And on a final note, on the morning of New Year's Day, Jenny Houser's grandmother, Jean Houser, passed away in her sleep. She was, as Jenny noted, 101. It was the day before her granddaughter's debut at the Met, which could only have been as inspired as the life Jean Houser lived. And from the after-party reports I received from Jenny's debut, it was indeed a performance inspired by an extraordinary life. I'm Robin Washington. Have an equally inspired and fulfilling new year. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Last week, we marked the new year with a look back at some of the bigger news stories we covered in 2019. Today, we take one more look back at the year in arts and entertainment in the region. A lot of these stories are recurring events, like the Homegrown Music Festival and Big Top Chautauqua. But some of our music, spoken word, and arts offerings were one-of-a-kind events that we found memorable and worth hearing once more. One of those was a visit by Minneapolis rocker Mark Maltman to Duluth's Red Herring Lounge just before it closed in June to read from his book, The Happiness Playlist. It was also an excuse for all of us to play our most uplifting songs, which we did when Maltman checked in with my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Walt Dizzle. Here's their conversation.
And I feel I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Minneapolis musician Mark Maltman about his book, The Happiness Playlist, the true story of healing my heart with feel-good music. It's a wonderful read, and I can't recommend it enough. The book is a candid look at your life. Was it hard to share the real Mark Maltman with an audience who really only knows you probably from your stage persona?
I mean, I didn't really think about it, you know. I wanted it to be true. You know, I had read this thing that said, you know, write the book you want to read. And I really like autobiographical stuff. So I just kind of journaled and didn't think about that. And I think it worked out.
Were there songs of the 50 that you've chosen for this book that people are like, no, I don't get that. That does not make me happy at all.
I always have this fail-safe answer when people try to argue me or want to rather argue with me about music. I always say I feel like music is like food, and we like what we like and we eat what we want to eat. There's not much arguing about, I don't like shrimp, you like shrimp. Are we going to sit around for an hour and try and convince each other to like shrimp? I don't really see that ever happening, because in reality, music is only music and it's there for us to enjoy as much as riding roller coasters or making out or, you know, eating a birthday cake. And we shouldn't judge other people by the music they love, and we shouldn't judge ourselves by the music that we love or don't love. So I don't believe in the term of a guilty pleasure. I really only believe in the idea of pleasure.
I could not agree more.
I'm a mean machine with gasoline dreams and a love so strong for everything.
I've been a fan of your music forever, and your on-stage persona is so happy, so bubbly, so over the top. Is that something that you've been in your true life up to this point as well, or is that kind of something that was a different than the real Mark Maltman?
It's always been different. From the very first time I started performing in a punk bands when I was young, I just started freaking out, and it wasn't really until I started like giving solo shows behind my albums and when I got it reined in, like around 2002, 2003, when I really like felt like I was on top of my game as far as like going the opposite, where some people might be too still on stage. I was just out of control. I feel like I've got it reined in, you know, but it is definitely a character that I go into. It's almost like it's been there my whole life and I just open it up and there's that guy. Because anyone who knows me in real life knows that I'm wildly different than the person on stage.
You said something in the book that's really very relatable. Can you talk about the notion of being addicted to sadness and anxiety? I think that in our social media and you know, the more we're bombarded with those feelings, I feel like that's a lot of people can relate to that.
I think addiction is a dangerous word because we throw it around in a certain amount of disregarding the people who are going through actual real addiction to controlled substances or alcohol or something like gambling. And those are real things that do require a lot of respect, and they're hard challenges for people to go through. But that said, I do feel that we our ego like tends to bias us towards negativity as artists, because it seems like those things are more critically received. Think of all the movies that like win Oscars and the critics say best film of the year up until this like superhero revolution. But before that, the movies were always like, oh no, this won an Oscar, I'm probably going to cry. Life is hard, but there's a difference between, you know, complaining and actually enduring hardship. See the West Wind move like a lover's soul. On the fields of barley, feel her body rise when you kiss her mouth among the fields of... The book that you've written, The Happiness Playlist, is obviously, you talk about some of the things that have been tough and some of the harder parts of your life, but it doesn't ever feel like it's wallowing, you know? Yeah, like here's the thing, like America is kind of a land of denial. We deny pain, we deny death. Even in the movies we create, you know, nobody, like the superhero is never hurt, is always indestructible. And everybody is going to lose somebody or a lot of people and going to get sick. You're going to break a toe. These are just parts of life. Life is a balance of sad stuff and happy stuff and good times and bad times. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish it was all good times, and I say that in the book. But the reality of life is that you have to endure hardships, but the attitude after the fact is really what shapes your personality. And I wanted to write a book that, and I feel like it did write a book that is a kind of a guided meditation. So when you read it, you feel better. Not just it's not an instructional book that says, hey, you know, here's what you do to feel happy, because I don't know that. All I know is that if I'm really in a bad mood, I say, hey, you know, this is not the time to put on your favorite Nine Inch Nails record. This is like, be easy on yourself, Mark.
I think you do a good job of really hitting the nail on the head of, like, everyone can take a look at their own lives and figure out what it is for them that, you know, sparks joy.
Yeah, there's a zeitgeist of positivity happening in our culture right now, which is necessary because we're almost in survival mode against this anger that's happening in our political climate and also with the collapse of our environment. There's a lot of fear in the air with violence among people of different cultures. And I feel like music is a great way to implement joy that is universal into the world. And I think maybe, you know, people scoff at positivity when they can afford to.
I feel like I should take notes, everything you say. It's a relatable book in the fact that it sounds like someone who's just listening to somebody who's been through things and has good ideas and decided, oh, I should write down what that guy said. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, since it is published on a self-help publisher, and I don't think people want to be sold something, and I don't think people want to be told something. And so I'm not an authority on how to be happy, and I'm not an authority on how to be perfect. I'm flawed and anxious and human like anybody else. And I felt like, wow, I don't know if I was like super rich and famous, if I would have been able to sit down and write this, you know? I think that if I would have been that guy, like the famous rock star that I thought I was going to be, I mean, the world famous rock star that I thought I was going to be when I was 16, and the verdict's still out, that might still happen. But but right now, I feel that, wow, it was a real blessing for me to just be able to sit down and write a book like about music, but from the perspective of a working class musician. You don't have to listen to difficult music to prove that you're smart.
What can we expect from the reading?
It's been really fun to do these readings, and I'm going to be doing a whole nationwide book tour in summer and fall. And it's just, I get to just bring a book in there, and it's funny, and it's everything that the book is. I read sections from the book, and there's a Q&A, and I'll sign the book, and it's that simple.
That was Mark Baumann, author of The Happiness Playlist, speaking in June with my colleague, Walt Dizzle. Not far from Baumann in the Twin Cities is another writer with a talent for evoking a mood, this time with a children's book. With her new volume, Home in the Woods, Eliza Wheeler draws from her roots in Solon Springs to tell the story of her grandmother, who grew up in the woods of Douglas County. In November, Wheeler shared her story with another of our WPR colleagues, Al Ross. Here's Eliza reading an excerpt, followed by their conversation.
Deep in these woods, we find a shack, all wrapped in tar paper. It's hot outside, but the shack looks cold and empty, like I feel inside. You never know what treasures we'll find, says Mum. In the shack, we don't see any treasures. Wooden table, empty crates, rusty oven, dusty shelf, potbelly stove, box springs. But Lowell and Eva find a door in the floor. Below is a root cellar filled with old glass jars, a tin pail, a pile of rags, and a pitcher pump that goes up and down, and out comes a stream of cool, clear water. This place will do fine, says my big brother Ray. But it doesn't seem like much of a home to me.
Eliza Wheeler is the author and illustrator, and the newest book is Home in the Woods. I have read about the bucolic upbringing you had in the North Woods, picking blueberries, skipping through the woods. Then there was a buffer in the fact that you went to Menominee for some stout schooling. But then you found yourself in Los Angeles doing graphic design, but you didn't like working on a computer, so that's my setup. Assuming there was a little bit of culture shock between Solon Springs and Los Angeles.
That's for sure. Yeah, Menominee, though, felt like a pretty big town. That was a good little introduction to traffic lights. So going to Menominee was nice. I went to school for graphic design.
Yeah. You liked art as a high school student?
I did.
As a kid,
absolutely. Just, grew up drawing nonstop. Mm. I knew that was where my passions were. And now I realize the sort of perfect balance between graphic design and fine art is really illustration. My husband and I moved out to Los Angeles after graduating and started job hunting. And
that was to help him pursue what he did, too.
Yeah. While we were there, I was working graphic design day jobs, and I went to a book festival, and I came upon the Society of Illustrators booth and chatted with some illustrators, and it was just this appealing thing to see they were making a profession as illustrators. And so I started thinking about that as a possibility. The illustration that I was always doing sort of in secret on the side just leaned in the direction of children's book illustration.
Did you do that even at Stout? Were you able to do your fine art at Stout?
I did a little bit, and I realize now that I really tried to sneak it in wherever I could. And going to a school where it's either graphic design or it's fine art, illustration wasn't really a part of the mix there.
Okay.
And so it wasn't totally encouraged, but I think every once in a while I would do a project that leaned in that direction and a professor would say, this is really good. You should think about this. I think the idea started creeping in while I was at Stout. And when my first niece, Madeline, was born, I made a little book for her. That was my first rookie, making all the mistakes of not the right number of pages, didn't research what a children's book should be like. It was just sort of a personal family gift.
Now, there is a quote in one of the reviews on the back of the dust cover of your new book, which we'll get to in a moment. You are said to have, quote, an intuitive knowledge of what the world looks like to a very small person, unquote. Is that the world that you visit before you dive into projects? You have to maintain that perspective.
Definitely, yeah. I love that quote. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's one of the biggest compliments I've ever gotten from a reviewer. And I think maybe what makes children's illustration such a natural fit for me as an artist is that I just still have very vivid visual memories of what childhood was like. Now I realize growing up in rural northern Wisconsin, it was a really special time and place because I grew up in this tiny town, lots of land to roam around. I lived surrounded by my grandparents and cousins, and so we just had a lot of space to play. I think drawing becoming the natural medium, it merges well with that clear memory of what childhood was like and felt like and how I experienced books when I read them as a kid.
Kids are bombarded with so much stuff nowadays. My favorite books when I was a kid had to do with painting a picture of some place I wanted to be.
Yeah,
I wanted
absolutely.
To go.
Yeah,
and that's
too.
What your woods thing is like.
Yes.
You sure wouldn't want to live like they had to live at the beginning, but
right.
once they had taken care of all of the bad stuff, you want to be there. And
yeah.
you doubt that there is a place like that. It's almost fantasy land. So.
Yeah. And it's neat because I think kids who grew up in rural Wisconsin or the rural Midwest will relate to these locations because they'll be able to recognize it for themselves. But kids who live in the city or who live in different regions, they'll get a little taste of what life is like here. Mm-hmm. And that's a really neat thing.
Yeah. Eliza Wheeler is the author and illustrator. And the newest book is Home in the Woods. She's from West and Northwest Wisconsin, folks, born and raised in Solon Springs. I bet you the people there and people here are awfully proud of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Al.
That was my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Al Ross, speaking in November with Eliza Wheeler, a Solon Springs native and author-illustrator of the new children's book, Home in the Woods. Coming up, can two violinists play the same piece over 1,000 miles apart? And West Duluth gets a new big screen. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We know we already treated you to opera, or tricked you, depending on your musical taste. But if we can perk your ears with just a little more classical, we have to give a nod to Aaron Aldridge, who, in addition to being the concertmaster of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra and professor at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, has been ever so gracious to come upstairs to our studios pretty regularly to give us on-air lessons in music appreciation. One of her very special performances was in August, when she teamed up with Superior High School and UWS alum Deanne Letourneau, concertmaster of the Las Vegas Philharmonic, for a concert by the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra. A few days before, Aaron joined us in the studio, and Deanne, with violin in hand, called us from Vegas. And so your program is quite ambitious. You're starting with Bach's Double Violin Concerto, which makes a lot of sense for two violins.
Yes.
Who came up with the repertoire?
I think we both did. It was collaborative.
As double violins should be. So I have this theory. I think I've maybe told you this one before, Aaron, which I call Robin's string theory, which has nothing to do with mathematics, but it sounds impressive. And that is that the first version of a work that you hear is in your head the right version. So I am forever searching for that Bach recording by who knows who of Bach's Double Violin Concerto. And to me, that's what I was imprinted with. I don't know, do you agree or am I crazy on that one?
I always think that when it comes to Bach, every violinist plays it their way, and their way is the right way. more than any other composer.
Deanne, do you agree with that or you have your way?
Oh, you know, no, I absolutely agree with it. You know, I think that when people get together, they, you know, they like Aaron said, it's like they have their way. But really great musicians are able to meld those two ways together. And it's just and then it's spectacular. That's why it's so much fun rather than just doing a concerto or something by yourself. It's really fun to do the double repertoire.
And I would add, though, with Deanne, I think it was very funny. We did a recital here at UWS a few years ago, and I remember the first rehearsal. And we started playing, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm playing with my twin. Like, I think that's why we love playing together so much. We actually refer to each other as each other's twin.
Yes.
In terms of violin, because our approach, our playing, everything is so similar, and we have completely different backgrounds, which is insane, but it is. But that's why it'll be really fun. We play so similarly.
It is very scary. Even the way we approach rehearsing, mm-hmm. and the way we approach, like, coming up with a program or doing things. I mean, it's just so organic. I love it. It is it's amazing.
So does a conductor have anything to do with it?
Absolutely not. One of those? No.
Oh, conductor?
No, the conductor does play into it, but we were given some free rein, which is always really fun, to come up with a program, like what would work for us.
So how do you give each other the cues for when to come in? I mean, particularly on the Bach piece, and let's hear... we'll play a sample, not necessarily of you playing it, but let our listeners hear it. Mm-hmm. That was Pinchas Zukerman and Yitzhak Perlman in their performance of Bach's Double Violin Concerto. And with me preparing for their version next week are Aaron Aldridge and Diane Letourneau. And so, yeah, how do you time coming in? It's not just one melody. It's two things going on at the same time.
Well, and that's like the standard keystone of what Bach did, is it's complex and it's very interesting and it's contrapuntal and it's not, you know, straightforward. I mean, the second movement's very beautiful, right. But the outer movements are this constant back and forth. And in terms of communication, I mean, because we're so similar, it's a very weird feeling when you meet kind of your match and you don't really have to say anything and it just sort of organically, naturally happens. Good. I mean, for sure, we'll look at each other and you cue, because you want to make sure also that the orchestra's on and the orchestra's with you.
There are other people on stage.
There are other people involved and very important people at that. But I think with Deanne and I, because we read each other so well, we don't have to talk a lot. We can just kind of do our thing.
Right. It's so easy. I think what Aaron is saying, you know, how intricate Bach really is, and yet at the same time is how well we two work together. I'm so looking forward to this because of that.
Mm-hmm. Is it a fight or is it a conversation? What's going on in that piece?
It's all of the above. For me, I would say the first movement is more of a conversation. And I would say the last movement is more of sort of like this interrupting fight thing going on.
I agree.
They agree on the fight. I love it. Well, I won't let the whole conversation be about that. The other pieces, the Haydn.
It's a great, great symphony, the Haydn. It's also, if you know the backstory behind the symphony, it's a very funny symphony. It's Haydn at his most politically savvy. He worked for the Esterházy residence way back, and he was in charge of all the musicians and in charge of writing the music.
And he got paid. These people had a lot of money, right?
Yeah, this was, you know, but really court composers and court musicians were essentially indentured servants. It was, I mean, they had some level of respect, but ultimately they were, you know, they were the servants of the Esterházy. And so they were at the summer palace, and Prince Esterházy was really enjoying his time at the summer palace, and the musicians were ready to go back home to their families, and they were really, really, really tired, and they just needed to go back, and the prince just was staying and staying and staying, and of course, you know, the musicians were complaining to Haydn, and Haydn decided, well, what is the best way for me to not insult anybody but get the point across that it's time to go home? So he wrote the Farewell Symphony, and hint, hint, because by the end of the symphony, there's only two musicians left on stage.
Well, this is where they got the idea for the Sound of Music for the
probably.
Hello, farewell.
Yeah, exactly. And little by little, and it's actually, he wrote it in the score, so it is written like bassoon ends, you leave. You know, last stand violin, you're done, leave. Even though the other violins are still playing, like, and you know, one by one, all the musicians leave, and it actually is written in the score. And so after the performance, the prince finally got the message, and it was in a very humorous and good-natured way, and he said, okay, we can go home. So they finally got home. But Haydn had to be very, you know, politically careful, but that was oftentimes through his music, how he was able to get things handled,
very clever,
shall we say.
So Haydn got things handled. But you're doing this before the intermission. Are you sure people are going to come back?
Depends how well we play.
we're giving the musicians an early break. It's always great.
Right. Actually, is the orchestra going to come back?
We hope.
Remember, the whole track family had cars waiting for them.
I think we may need to bring cookies or something.
Exactly.
So could we hear some things? Now, we're going to use the magic of not just radio, but something called a telephone. Deanna's been talking to us from Vegas, so the adage about what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas is not true when you're on the phone and you're talking on the radio.
You know, that would
this has never been done on a radio before, by the way.
Yes. Never been done on radio, and it would actually be a really interesting experiment.
It would be. I actually, you know what I have for memory?
Yeah.
Though, it's like if we did the opening of the Paganini.
Oh, you. sure.
No, like just just the theme. We could just play the theme.
Oh, want to just do the theme? We could just do the theme.
I think I can wing that. Oh,
this could be really interesting. It's never been done before. I think this is a new first. I think.
First need to do is make sure our A's are tuned in with
it. Now, I just got the violin on. Do you have a...
Count off. I'll just come in.
Okay. All right. One, two. One, two.
Hey!
You just heard the first separated by 1,000 miles or whatever it was. Dual duet something.
Oh, that's so fun.
So I can say the first on Wisconsin Public Radio, I think. So.
There you go.
That's fantastic.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we've been
talking. Thank you so much, Robin.
That was Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra Concertmaster Aaron Aldridge, along with Superior native and Aaron's Las Vegas Philharmonic counterpart, Deanne Letourneau, speaking with us before their joint Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra concert in August. And on to the big screen, and in particular, a brand new big screen gracing a historic movie theater in Duluth, West Duluth to be precise. The West Theater is back in business after painstaking, and I mean painstaking, renovations overseen by proprietor Bob Boone. He's the publisher of the Duluth Reader, who was first bit by the movie theater bug decades ago in Superior. Hello, Bob Boone.
Hello, Robin. Thanks for coming to me.
And we're here because what have you done to the West Theater, and why are you involved?
I'm involved because actually I'm from Superior, and while I was a UWS student, somebody made me the manager of the historic Palace Theater on Tower Avenue. So when I was 19 years old, I suddenly had 16 employees, and I was running a grand old theater and hiring and firing and advertising and payroll and inventory and accounting. It was like the best job ever for a college student. And it spoiled me because I haven't worked for anybody else since. One day, about three and a half years ago, I was walking out of Beaner Central and we saw a building for sale across the street. And my better half, Carol, suggested that maybe we want to look at moving the Reader office and buy a building. And I said, I don't want to move the Reader office here. And Besides, that's not a building, that's a theater. And she said, oh no, because she knew what was coming next. And I started exploring it and discovered that this was a streamlined, modern variant of Art Deco. And it was a theater that had been closed since the mid 70s. And I thought West Duluth really needed a theater. The nearest theater is downtown, and the next nearest one is in Cloquet. There was a young man named David Orman who owned the building, and he said, listen, I have all sorts of people interested in this building, but what this building really needs to be is a theater, if it ever can be. So I'll tell you what, give me a check for $500 as a deposit, and I'll hold it until you can figure out whether this is a real project. And he held the check for 11 months. My theater, not to brag, was in much worse shape than the North Shore Theater. There were no seats, projectors, heat in the auditorium. The ceiling was rotted. I'm kind of impressed or surprised that they managed to spend $32 million on it. Our project came in at $1.5 million, and that was $500,000 over budget, mostly due to delays. But we ended up... with the help, actually, the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund was a strong supporter of this idea and helped steer me in a lot of the right directions. So we did a business plan with the help of UMD and found some financing. The city did lend us $50,000 as part of this deal. The initial budget, I think, came in at $950,000. We replaced a quarter of the roof, and we put a new marquee on the front because the old marquee was completely gone. Redid all the windows and doors. As I said, Northeast Entrepreneur Fund was the first one to help us organize the direction. And then they recommended I talk with Park State Bank. They agreed to be involved, and then Northspan agreed to lend a little bit of money. And then the city agreed to a $50,000 loan.
How long was the whole construction period?
It was projected to be a two-year project. When we went $300,000 over budget, the bankers decided to pause. So we were on hold for 9 months while they explored what the remaining costs would be. Eventually, they decided to pull the trigger and continue. And 4 months after that, we opened.
Let's take a look.
Okay.
So we walked in past the ticket counter, and where are we now?
We are in the blue lounge. I didn't know we were going to do this, but we have black and blue lounges. And this one is a new creation used because we had to construct new bathrooms. To improve handicapped accessibility, we had to make quite a few changes, and we ended up reducing the size of the auditorium to make it handicapped accessible and to create the bathrooms that modern society expects.
So we're in the blue lounge.
Yes, it's full of antique rose-colored mirrors salvaged from the North Shore Theater. And that's a real 1940 Art Deco sofa with leaf springs instead of coil springs. We found antiques for the theater in 20 states, Canada, England, and Portugal.
That looks like something called a radio.
That is a radio. Period correct, and it looked good in that corner. Doesn't really do anything for a movie theater, and it was certainly money wasted according to the bankers.
And we're walking into the auditorium.
Yes, here you find a 247-seat theater where we found drawings that allowed us to match the look of the walls and the ceilings as they originally were. We have more modern, comfortable seats, much like you'd find in a top-drawer theater in Minneapolis, and a 29-foot-wide screen for our movies. We also have a retractable screen, which allows us to be a pretty decent, smaller concert hall.
I see there's a, I won't quite call it a mezzanine area, but I take it this is for wheelchair users.
Yes, we poured a concrete pad to allow seating for roughly a dozen disabled people and their attendants, which too often, I broke my leg once and I was in a cast for 9 months, and so I had a short appreciation of the difficulties people go through. These are maybe some of the best seats in the house. We put a fair amount of thought into trying to make them a good place to go. We also have caption assistance for people with hearing disabilities. Beautiful aluminum curved handrails made by Katzmarek Iron Fence in Proctor, Minnesota. We have purple-colored light sconces along the left and right wall because we discovered purple neon that still worked. We built a riser that's good for either a piano or a drummer's set that's permanently mounted on the stage. We have a green room that we had to invent by putting it above the fire exit. So we built a set of stairs across the stage.
I have to say, $1.5 million seems pretty cheap, actually.
Well, there was one time we were
everything I'm looking at here looks basically brand new. I suppose the walls, well, no, you said the plaster was falling down, so.
The walls were brick, and we had to put furring strips, then insulation, then plywood, then carpeting, and then two-toned and three-toned carpeting to recreate the patterns we knew were on the wall. And then as construction was wrapping up, the contractor came in and installed sprinkler heads. I then came back the very next day and said, take the sprinklers out of here. They didn't have sprinklers in 1937, and I know we have to have them, but there have to be less obvious sprinkler heads than that. So those little black dots you see up there are sprinkler heads that pop down. I did not make any friends that day. The antique popcorn machine is a 1946 Manley, and we found it in Pittsburgh. And we had to go there with a pickup truck and lots of blankets and lay it down and haul it back.
Congratulations, Andy.
Thank you. That's very kind.
We've been visiting with Bob Boone, publisher of the Reader Weekly and more recently, owner, proprietor, and renovator of the West Theater in West Duluth. That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. On a final note, on the morning of New Year's Day, Jenny Hauser's grandmother, Jean Hauser, passed away in her sleep. She was, as Jenny noted, 101. It was less than 48 hours before her granddaughter's debut at the Met, which could only have been as inspired as the life Jean Hauser lived. From the after-party reports I received late last night, it was a performance worth celebrating. I'm Robin Washington. Have an equally inspired and fulfilling New Year.